My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to this week's Mysteries and Monsters. Well, we've had a great response to our last episode featuring Linda Godfrey, so thank you for all the kind words. I'm glad to know people are enjoying what we do. This week, I'm joined by one of Britain's most prolific paranormal authors, Jeff Holder. Jeff has written over 30 books covering mysterious and ghostly occurrences in Scotland, but today we discuss his magnum opus, Poltergeist Over Scotland. It was Jeff's intent to create a companion volume to the legendary ghost hunter Harry Price, whose book Poltergeist Over England was released way back in 1945. Jeff's book covers over 500 years of poltergeist cases from Scotland and is a must for anyone interested in polts, spooks and things that go bump in the night. Don't forget, before we dive into the interview, to follow us on Facebook, we're on Instagram and Twitter, and keep subscribing to our YouTube channel. The more subscribers we get, the more people can find the show. Don't forget you can also support us on Patreon for $1 a month. Now, let's take a journey into Scotland's haunted history. My guest tonight needs no introduction if you've read any books about ghosts, ghoulies and poltergeists in Scotland over the last 15 years, with over 25 books covering more ghosts and hauntings than you can shake a Bible at. Jeff Holder has produced some of the best written and most well-researched books about the paranormal I've ever had the privilege to read. He's now moved into TV and film as a screenwriter, with a couple of films already released, and Dark Sense received its world premiere at the Boston Sci-Fi Festival in February of this year. Jeff, thank you and welcome to joining Mysteries and Monsters today.
You're very welcome.
So, most authors, I would suggest, probably aren't as prolific and as consistently good as yourself, Jeff. You've released enough books about the paranormal to have your own section in a library. Where on earth did this prolific love of the paranormal come from?
It is basically living the dream. to be very concise, I grew up in an industrial city where one's horizons for the future were very limited. Mm. And I found my escape in the local library, where I had read every book, every horror book, every supernatural book, every fantasy and sci-fi book by the time I left primary school. Mm. And now I get to write about that stuff, which is, you know, pretty cool.
It is. It is. I mean, was it a conscious, I mean, obviously, it sounds like you had a very similar childhood to myself, because I grew up in a towards the end of the miners era in South Yorkshire. So essentially, you had two choices, which was either stay and fight off boredom for the rest of your life, or move on and try and get away and push yourself more, Jeff. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of those aspects that at that era that the library becomes a kind of escape from the normality of those kind of that kind of upbringing, really. So it's interesting that you kind of embraced it and developed it. Was it something you consciously then moved into after leaving school, Jeff?
No. It took me decades, possibly centuries past before I kind of had a, I suppose, a small revelation. I was living in Scotland, and I was spending my weekends exploring the area, going to all the stone circles and the castles and all the fantastic historical sites. And I thought, what I need is a book that tells me where all these places are and tell me about the folklore and stories and the mysteries associated with those. And I couldn't find a book, so I decided to write it. And that was called The Guide to Mysterious Perthshire. And I pitched it to a publisher, which, and I said, you publish books on local history and you publish books on the history of witchcraft. I'm in the middle. And they said, yeah, okay. And that led to a series of similar books about specific locations in Scotland, The Guide to Mysterious Glasgow, Aberdeen, Skye, and so on, and also the Lake District. So I kind of developed I suppose, a niche, and that sort of enabled me to eventually give up my job and become a full-time author.
Fantastic. So, when was your first book released then, Jeff?
2006.
Yeah, so it was kind of like as you refer to, a revelation that you essentially just embraced and just went for the opportunity then.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, I had this remarkable moment. I'd had three books published with the same publisher, and I was, still working full time. And they said, what else you got? And I pitched them six ideas, expecting them to say yes to one. They said yes to all six,
Wow.
and I thought, okay, maybe I should give up my job and do this all the, full time.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, do you think that it's been more beneficial for you that you've kind of got into this later in life and you've kind of moved into it as a career rather than kind of trying to create that niche as you refer to, as a younger person?
I can't say whether it was more beneficial. It's just something that happened. It wasn't part of the plan, and then it became the plan.
Absolutely. So, was it a natural progression? As you refer to, you started doing the mysterious books primarily because there wasn't that kind of guide for someone interested in those subjects out there. Did you kind of, as that developed, did you start to think, well, I need to start looking at more specific parts of the paranormal, or did it was a natural progression once again?
Well, yeah. What the life of an author is very much, how shall we say, a series of negotiations with publishers, which is basically, I want to write this, and publisher says no. And eventually, you say, I want to write this. They say, yeah, okay, you can write that one. But also, it. What I was doing, I was basically doing lots of boots on the ground research. I was basing myself in a certain part of Scotland, and I would go around everywhere in that location. And I found myself doing things like visiting lots and lots of graveyards, as you do. So I visited, there's a pathological amount of Scottish graveyards, and I thought, there's something really unusual going on here. There's lots of stories about grave robbing, body snatching. So I wrote a book about body snatching, simply because I'd been to all these graveyards, and I was finding lots of stories about witchcraft. So I wrote a book on witchcraft, and then as I was accumulating these stories about hauntings, about ghosts, sort of folkloric stories, I was also accumulating tales and episodes about poltergeists, and poltergeists are very fascinating for me because, unlike folkloric stories, with poltergeists, particularly more recent cases, what you have is sometimes physical evidence, but often you have multiple eyewitness evidence and documentary evidence. And that means that someone like me can interrogate that evidence. And it also suggests there's something about poltergeists that are very different to other elements of what we call the paranormal. And it occurred to me, if poltergeists are real, or should I say, if some of the poltergeist phenomena is evidential, then laws of physics are being broken.
Yeah.
And if laws of physics are being broken in reality as this thing from people making up stories or misinterpreting what they've experienced, then there's a new paradigm there. And that's really fascinating to me, that poltergeist could be a kind of the window into finding a new way of analysing and understanding the universe.
Yeah. I mean, I have a very similar love of poltergeist, out of all aspects of the paranormal, Jeff. It's the one thing that gets my juices flowing, because I just find them incredibly fascinating. As you refer to some of the more modern cases and, you know, infamous cases such as Enfield.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky enough to speak to Dr. Melvin Willin, who I know in your volume of Poltergeist Over Scotland. You acknowledge him in the beginning of the book, because obviously I was a small child when that happened. I wasn't far off the age of the children involved. So, and obviously at the time it was all over the Daily Mirror, and it was a big sensation for a young lad living in a boring town. It's the one thing I've always gravitated towards in regards to the paranormal, and they are just perplexing.
Yes, as I said, somewhere about, you know, whatever theory you have about poltergeists, they will trump it. They will behave differently to the way you think that poltergeists, whatever you think poltergeists are, they will decide to do the opposite. If at all they decide to do anything, begs the question.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, there are many a case of poltergeists that seem to enjoy the attention,
mm-hmm.
and end up performing for a variety of witnesses. But
yeah,
I mean, your book, as I just mentioned, Poltergeist Over Scotland. Ironically, I just finished Harry Price's.
Oh, right, yeah.
Poltergeist Over England, and I saw your, and I wasn't aware you'd done another Poltergeist book, because I think you've done two, haven't you?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And the first one was fascinating. So for me, I just thought, well, this is fantastic, because the one criticism I would have over Price's original book was the fact that it was just so focused on England. I mean, it's a massive volume,
mm-hmm.
by any stretch of the imagination, specifically just dealing with cases on poltergeist in England. So to see yours, for me, it was a perfect compliment, and I just found it an incredible work. It was a fantastic book, Jeff.
Well, thank you so much, sir. And the money will be in the post for you soon.
I mean, the one thing I've always enjoyed about your work is that, you know, as I referred to in the introduction, they're excellently written, and they're pitched at a level of not necessarily intellect, but very often you can read books about the paranormal and it's very simplistic, Jeff. And I think you give credit to the reader by the way that you write, and it's. It's a challenging read if you're not used to that kind of level of depth and also a dark strand of humour that seems to permeate your work, which I appreciate entirely. Did you find it easy to, because of your experience on the other books, because like I say, the Poltergeist book is so well researched and the depth in it is staggering in places, Jeff.
Did I find it easy to research?
Yeah, I mean, because of how much depth in the Poltergeist book.
Okay, the previous volumes have basically taught me how to research, because I hadn't been trained in this area. Paul, you cannot imagine just how extensive my library on the subject is. Yeah, I have got, you know, everything that I could get my hands on.
Yeah.
And I spend a great deal of time sifting through archives. I spend a great deal of time going through, you know, not only the national archives in Edinburgh, but local archives in specific towns and cities, where I found some hint or some mention of a poltergeist case. And then I started looking through, you know, newspapers and journals, and The more you look and the dustier you get, I can tell you that your hands, your fingers are covered with black stuff when you open these things that haven't been looked at for possibly decades, maybe centuries. You discover more and more. And that it was easy because it was a pleasure, but it was real solid hard work for months to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I can appreciate that because, like I said, I mean, the cross-referencing and the some of the research that's gone in, like I say, I mean, the one thing that struck me after reading it is that the first part of the book is obviously dealing with the earliest cases because obviously you've done the whole thing chronologically. And it's weird for me that there just seems to be a complete absence, well, not absence, but the change from the reporting of poltergeists in the 17th century to near enough the suppression of it throughout the 18th century. Because I find it really odd that it just seems to, I think you refer it, to it in the second part where you say that it's kind of poo-pooed by the intellectuals and it's old-fashioned thoughts and a more simplistic view of the world.
Yes, everything in human experience, including experience of the paranormal, is fashion. Our fashions change depending on the world in which we live in. And in the 16th century and the 17th century, people believed in Satan. They believed in demons and they believed in witchcraft and they believed in ghosts. So that was just part of the life of majority of people, certainly the majority of people in the countryside. By the 18th century, we have the Enlightenment, and a new intellectual wave spreads throughout Europe, and it did a great deal of good. It brought sort of Britain and Europe more into a sort of modern way of thinking, and a lot of the Enlightenment thinking was that everything to do with I mean everything to do with witchcraft and the supernatural was basically superstition, that it was therefore to be disregarded, and that it would be a bit like saying you went into your local Tesco's and say, "I believe in fairies." People would just laugh at you because in the intellectual context of our time, fairy belief is not very current. Whereas if you were in a pub in the 17th century and said, "I believe in witches," nobody would disagree with you. But in depending on your level of education, depending on your status in society, by the 18th century, you might well start to believe that. It doesn't mean that poltergeist cases stopped. It's simply that they stopped being reported. That's the big difference.
I mean, the other aspect of it is it's not only is it a fantastic record of the history of poltergeists in Scotland, but it's very interesting. You can see the cultural changes as well as you touched on there, because obviously in the first part of the book, everything's kind of attributed to Satan. It's the devil at work and possession and things like that. And then by the time you've got to sort of the latter part of the 18th and early 19th century, they're ghosts. They've become a standalone phenomena.
Yes, that's right. Satan has been banished. Witchcraft doesn't exist. The fairies are something that is something only deals with for children. And so what can they be? Well, they can either be hoaxes, frauds, or they can be ghosts. That's pretty much all that's left.
And it is interesting as well. I mean, the other thing that is a comparison with the Price book is that a lot of the early reports, it seems that the only people that were taking these situations seriously was the local reverend or church minister across the country.
In many cases, this is particularly for the older cases in Scotland. This is related to the gosh, what we can call it, what can cause internecine religious warfare. That that afflicted the country for a very long time. And it's not just between Protestants and Catholics. It was between various strands of Protestantism. And as part of that, as a sort of a parallel thing to go, that we had the rise of skepticism, that people, even by the 17th century, people were saying, well, I'm not sure that there really are witches. I'm not sure about this. And so many vicars, many religious men, many Protestant religious men were writing pamphlets and books, basically saying there is Satan. Satan does exist. Witches exist. Because if you don't believe in Satan and witches, you don't believe in God. And they had this real fear of atheism, which wasn't real atheism, but they had this real fear that their worldview was under attack. And so to protect it, to defend it, they came up, well, not they came up with, but they were using the poltergeist phenomena as proof of demonic forces. And if demonic forces exist, then therefore God exists. And to deny the demonic forces is to deny God. That's basically the argument in a great many of the 17th century poltergeist pamphlets.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly an absorption of superstition, in a way to kind of, I wouldn't necessarily say embrace these people, but to certainly encourage them that perhaps if they weren't regular attenders at the local church, or they weren't particularly involved in that part of the community, that the door was open for them because they understood it.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, I mean it is crucial, I think, like you say, and it's very interesting the way that, especially when it comes to the paranormal and religion, they become very much intertwined when it seems that one is overpowering the other, in especially in perhaps some more remote areas of not just Scotland, but it would have been the same around the UK at the same time, I would imagine.
Absolutely. And the essence is that I think probably ever since the Reformation, but probably a bit later, religion, the Christian religion in Britain has felt under attack, from science, from skepticism, from enlightenment thinking, from people just not paying attention to go to church anymore. And that many of these episodes provide opportunities for the people from the church to insert themselves into the narrative, and say that it's the work of Satan, and turn to God and everything will be fine.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we can see a very modern comparison of that because obviously the Catholic Church over the last few years has constantly gone about what you could call, in essence, a recruitment drive for exorcists.
A branch of the Catholic Church, within the Catholic Church, is actually quite controversial. But you're right, there has been a growth in exorcists, and therefore there's been a growth in demand, which meets a growth in demand for exorcism. And we have to wonder why that is happening. Seems to be principally in a number of European countries, Africa as well. And I honestly don't know why it is happening, but it is something that is evident, that perhaps something that even only 50 years ago, some more of the enlightened members of the Catholic Church would have said, no, we can't pay attention to this because this makes us look superstitious and backward. We have to go along the line of science and say it's something to do with psychology, it's something to do with what's happening in people's minds. Now we seem to be seeing a backlash against that, where we're saying, well, actually, you know what? Satan is still active, and we still need exorcists to get rid of him and his minions.
Yeah, I mean it's a very interesting cultural response, I think, because these days the paranormal is seen by many as light-hearted entertainment for me. With a myriad of ghost hunting programs are, I would imagine, shown in every country in the world these days.
You'd be really surprised. I live in France at the moment, and the French do not take the supernatural seriously at all. There is no French equivalent of most haunted or anything like that. That just doesn't, that kind of stuff. But I do know that, I mean, like in the US, Canada, and Spain has some as well. Russia has got one. It depends on the culture, but they are very widespread. And as you said, they are entertainment.
Yes, there is no doubt about that because they're certainly not the most serious investigatory
Moving on.
Yeah, thank you for that. So, I mean, in regards to the poltergeist phenomenon, I mean, were you surprised? Because I certainly was to see the number of cases in Scotland.
Yes, I was. Once I started researching, I'd only heard of some of the more notorious cases, the big numbers. But when I started digging further and further, I was truly astonished. 134 cases from the 1630s to 2012. And that seems to me quite a lot. For a small nation.
Yeah, and especially when you take into consideration, as we've touched on a couple of times, that one of the chapters is essentially 10 pages for a whole century.
Yes, because it was unfashionable, so nobody was noting them down, because that it was in, to do so would be to embarrass yourself to write about these things in that in that particular intellectual climate.
It's intriguing, and I mean, I'm sure some people would make the connection between the religious belief and community being quite strong up and continuing well into the 20th century in Scotland, but I'm sure others would perhaps point to a wider spiritual connection with the paranormal as well in the way that traditions and folklore has been an integral part of the Scottish nation.
Perhaps you should speak to someone Scottish about that.
Well, yes, that's true. That's true. But I found it, like I say, an incredible amount for a small country, and so well reported as well. And it's there seems to be a real, I mean, on a couple of cases, there seems to be a bit of pride in specific cases and what it brought to the area, strangely.
Yes, in some cases, and but often these things were they were what you might call the pride comes in books that were written long after the events. It's a sort of looking back, not nostalgia isn't quite the word, but there is a sort of sense of historical achievement, if you like, in some of these works that were published long after the actual events that took place.
Yeah, I mean it is like you say, a very fascinating aspect of it, because it just seems that certain areas of Scotland, it's for them it's second nature that if something weird goes off, well, it's clearly poltergeist. That's there's no ifs and buts, really.
Well, I don't know about that. Because firstly, the word poltergeist isn't known until the fourth decade of the 19th century, at least not in the English language. And it's not really well known as a word up until perhaps a certain film came out in the late 70s, early 80s. But to ascribe it to a poltergeist is often describing it to something else. It's a ghost. It's witchcraft. It's a demon. And then it's or it's or it's a hoax. There is certainly a very extensive and rich seam of poltergeist material in Scottish life.
I mean, as you refer to there, the catch-all every case is a hoax, tends to really push the boundaries of of what could be accepted as an explanation, because some of these cases you've got scores of witnesses, not just a couple.
Yeah, scores of, you've got police officers, you know, you've got members of the local gentry, you've got respectable tradespeople, you know, you've got really convincing sets of witnesses who, and in some cases, have put their names to written documents saying these things did happen, which is a big thing, I would say, for someone, a respectable member of society.
Well, I mean, clearly that shows the conviction they have in what what they've experienced, because, like you say, there are numerous cases where, you know, there are several that refer to the sporadic breaking out of fires, which I've always found a fascinating subsection of poltergeist phenomenon, because that doesn't tend to happen very often. Certainly seems to occur in the ones where it's got a whole range of tricks for its intended audience.
And I did a breakdown of the percentages of various effects, and if I remember rightly, fires took place in about 5%, something like that, of the cases. Fire or smoke in almost 12% of the cases, and most of those cases were early cases. There's not much fire in recent cases.
Yeah, that is something I've noticed now you point that out, and it's the same with the prize book about England. It seems to be a very specific, you know, sort of 18th, 19th century where they got a bit paramaniacal about things.
Yeah. And I mean, it may be something else. There may be a material element to this. If you look at the early cases, they mostly take place in rural locations, and there's going to be lots of things that can catch fire there. So that is to say, there's lots of material. So perhaps in the more modern, I mean, I'm speculating here, but perhaps in the more modern cases, there's less material for the pult to play with. But there are things such as water. Water is plentiful. There's electricity. There's telephones. There are the new things that pults can play with. Mm. So maybe it's simply that the pults are evolving. They're adapting to our material circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, that is a fascinating aspect, that when you think about it, obviously they seem to adapt to the advances in human technology, as though they think, oh, brilliant, we've got a new toy to learn about.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's only a few years ago the pult started, in the famous case in England, the pult started communicating via mobile phone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey, that's a chiller, that one. It's a very, very scary story.
But I
just found it. I mean, there's a very famous case from Germany where one of the key aspects of that case, along with the usual moving of furniture and pictures and light fittings, was that the speaking clock was just basically rung like a machine gun.
It was being dialed so much faster than a human could dial it.
And I know they try to replicate it, and it just beggars belief, because you get these people come. I mean, they had the phone company come out, check the wiring, they rewired it, it still carried on, and nobody could replicate the speed of the dialing under any circumstances. It was incredible.
It's another example of pulse doing things that seem to defy physical laws. You know, and that's one of the reasons why they're so fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's an incredible array of phenomena that they tend to bring. Some of the most prolific tend to. It's as if they build strength through some, because often these cases start quite slowly, reach a crescendo, and then either just stop suddenly or they just drift away like a whimper.
You've got it exactly. Pult cases almost never start with a big bang. They build up gradually, and as you say, they reach a crescendo, and sometimes that crescendo is brief and intense, And other times the crescendo can last for days or even weeks, but as yet, and then it stops or fades away for no apparent reason. Just in the same manner, it starts for no apparent reason. That's the classic arc of a poltergeist event.
Yeah, and I mean, it's always been interesting because I've always found them curious cases, because it's very easy to say, oh, well, it's all down to puberty and electrical discharge and things like that. And then you come across cases where, well, that's not happening because there is nobody going through puberty, or there's no children of that age in that area. So then you think, well, it's the same kind of phenomena, so surely that's not the reason then. Or do you think there are different aspects to different poltergeist cases, Jeff?
Well, firstly, the notion of the disturbed adolescent became a kind of default.
Yeah.
Now, but at one point in the 20th century, it was cutting edge ideas. It was an analysis of numerous poltergeist cases, very much in the United States, and they found at their center a disturbed adolescent, someone who was either going through puberty or was having problems in their life. And the suggestion was that this was their internal turmoil was being externalized, which fits the evidence from a wide range of cases. And because it was such a great idea, somehow became adapted and became, well, this must be the only explanation. But numerous poltergeist cases do not have, as you say, they do not have, not only they don't have a disturbed adolescent, they don't have an adolescent at all. There are pol cases that appear to people who are aged, to very young children. There are pol cases where the polt seems to move from person to person, which once again indicates that there is really no taxonomy of polts, because whatever you think they are, they do something different. They're just perverse.
Yeah, but that's a very good description of them. I tend to think of they've in quite a lot of the biggest cases, there's a dark sort of malevolent sense of humour to some of their games and the aspects of what they've unleashed.
I think they kind of act a bit like playground bullies. there's a kind of gleeful, low-key sadism that they seem to exhibit. Is this indicative of some kind of conscious force behind it? I have no idea, but it does. Some of the cases do seem to suggest that we're dealing with not the brightest bunch of entities from the supernatural lexicon, but possibly some of the most not the evil, but the kind of unthinking vandals.
Yeah, they don't seem to have any sort of perception of what their actions would cause.
No, it's just like I'll do this because I can, and because I enjoy tormenting people.
Yeah, I think that's another good point to that, because the other aspect is if you think about the amount of cases where there are people who claim to have been physically injured in such hauntings, they're not that numerous either when you consider this explosion of energy, Jeff.
Yes, I mean, if pulse can move objects through the air, can push heavy furniture, can displace objects through walls, can turn glass objects into its component sand, can set fires, and can mess with electricity, the energy output is astonishing. And yet, relatively little of it is pointed directly towards humans in a really dangerous manner. They hurt, but they don't kill.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I mean, the only case that jumps out, and I'm sure you'll correct me if you can think of any others, Jeff, is obviously the Bell Witch
yes.
from the States, where obviously that was a yes. concerted campaign against the father of the family.
That's a very good example. There's a couple of examples in my book of really early, like 17th century stuff, where they injured animals. But I can't think of any. I can't think of a fatal event in certainly in Scotland involving a poult.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. I mean, there are numerous cases where people have, you know, received scratches and
mm-hmm.
And the feeling of being physically attacked. I think Pontefract is a famous case where the daughter was dragged up the stairs backwards.
Pushing, shoving, punching, scratching, slapping. Mm. These things take place. In the cases in the book, I think it's about 14% of the cases had some form of assault.
Yeah, absolutely. Which in the perception of it is still quite a small amount, really.
Yes, when you consider that the vast majority of poult cases revolve around the movement of objects and the making of noises.
Yeah, I always enjoy the ones where they start off going a bit ooh and making funny noises, and then within a certain period of time, all of a sudden, they're capable of having conversations, or they suddenly develop a vein of sarcasm with any sort of communication, which I always find hilarious.
A number of poults develop distinct personalities.
Mm.
They either lecture people or they have conversations with people. Now, here's a curious thing about what we were talking earlier about poults adapting to the period. In the 17th century, poults would talk about religion. You know, they would argue religion with ministers. You don't find poults doing that nowadays. You know, nobody would go. People just go, well, what are you talking about? That's just boring. You know, I don't even know what you're saying. But at the time, it was something that Scottish poults anyway, seemed to be quite passionate about.
Yeah, they seem to appreciate the theological challenge.
Yeah, and there's this case from Greenock in the late 19th century where the investigator thought he heard amongst the thumps some kind of musical tune. Mm. So he whistled the tune and the poult banged in time to the tune. So the guy then whistled two more well-known Scottish airs, and the poult tapped along in time to the music.
Yeah,
I mean, that to me is absolutely astonishing, because what do poults know about music? Because no other poult I've heard about can carry a tune.
Yeah.
But by and large, people don't sing to poults, people don't whistle to poults. But in this case, this guy did. And that's how it responded.
Yeah, I found it quite an interesting reversal of the mimicry, because usually it's, you know, one tap for no, two taps for yes.
Yeah.
And he kind of turned the table and said, right, well, give me your best aria and we'll see what we can do. You hum it, I'll play
it. Wouldn't it be great if something like that happened to, like, a rap artist? That would just be great, that would be.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Yeah, a rap battle across the
realms. A rap battle with a poult, yeah.
I'm sure if we go searching for it, Jeff, I'm positive we'll find somebody on YouTube that claims to be able to rap with Biggie Smalls or Tupac.
I have no doubt, yes.
There, well, that's my homework for later, I think.
Yeah.
But I'll not share my endeavours. It's an intriguing, like you say, the whole thing. It would be interesting because these days there doesn't seem to be many vocal poltergeist case reported.
Yeah, they if they communicate at all, and then the rare cases where they do, it's by arranging letters on a fridge or on a wall, by writing or by mobile phone. They tend not to speak. Why is that? I have no idea.
Yeah, Well, perhaps once again, they're culturally absorbing what it is to be a millennial.
Yes. Yeah, maybe yes.
Who knows? You know, that maybe that's the thing. I mean, there was there's a wonderful podcast from the States called Monsters and Moments, which involves people ringing up with their own experiences across a whole range of 40 topics.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a gentleman that rang recently who was FaceTiming someone. I think it was his cousin, and she was at her boyfriend's house. And he was chatting to her, and he didn't think anything of it. But there was a gentleman sat behind his cousin. So the next time he talked to her, he's like, oh, yeah, brilliant. Who was the guy? Because her boyfriend was Mexican, and this was an old white guy just sat randomly on a settee. And apparently she'd complained about problems in the house, things moving about, noises and stuff. So she was stunned. And I was thinking, there seems to be not many of those type of kind of situations occur recently either.
No, not that many that I've heard of.
Yeah, so it's weird how it seems to only. But then again, I suppose with the myriad, I know there's a few alleged, you know, YouTube accidental videos and oh my god, what's this?
I've just had something in my throat there. So.
Yes, my tongue is firmly in my cheek because I've yet to see a compelling one. But it's that seems quite odd in its uniqueness as well, because that's quite a well attested story.
Hmm.
I mean, would you suspect that that's something that would develop, or do you think that, as you refer to there, poltergeists just aren't really that bothered in that kind of media at the moment?
You know, I've never actually spoken to a poltergeist. I've never been able to sit down and interview one, so I don't know how they think, if indeed they do think, if indeed they do have some kind of conscious thinking apparatus. Mm. I could answer that in one way, and tomorrow a polt will turn up somewhere and do something completely different. Yeah, they are adaptive, but we can't predict their adaptation.
Yeah, very much. Well, I think it's one of those things, isn't it? Because as numerous cases attest to, just when you think you've got its number, it moves on to something else. It's gone, right, okay, you think you've bested me at this. I'll do this, you know. I mean, one of the most consistent aspects of them is the incredibly loud noises that seem to occur in a large number of cases that are, you know, deafening to the people that hear them. And yet often there is zero evidence or source for such an aspect of a phenomenon.
You may be aware of an article that appeared in 14 Times and elsewhere a number of years ago, where an acoustic engineer analyzed the taps that have been recorded at poltergeist events. Do you know about this?
No.
To me, it's one of the most amazing pieces of recent scientific-based research. So a number of poltergeist taps have been recorded in different locations, mostly in Europe, some in the UK. Mm. And he took these recordings and he analyzed the sound. Now, when you hit like your desk with your knuckles, what happens is that there is a rise in noise and then it decays. Mm. Okay, that's what happened. And the rise in noise is very, very speedy.
Yeah.
But then there's a decay. And he analyzed these sounds and he said it doesn't behave like somebody hitting the surface. It behaves as if the noise is generated from within the material. Mm. Which, you know, begs the question, how does a pulse do that? But it seems to be that it's not hitting the object and to make that noise. Mm. It's generating sound in a different way, which once again is back to something that we've mentioned again and again, which is that pulse seem to break what we currently considered to be the laws of physics.
Yeah. I mean, there is numerous cases. I mean, there's one case that you refer to, I think, from the 18th century, sorry, where one of the descriptions of the noise is it sounded like a sledgehammer, but muffled.
Mm.
But the noise seemed to emanate from within the wall rather than be a response to being struck.
Yes, yes. And that is absolutely typical. When you have lots of loud noises, we're so used to loud noises being created by two objects striking each other. That's how noise is created. But the pulse seem to have a different idea of how to make noise.
Yeah, it's as if they can construct it on a molecular level.
Yes, that is the kind of thing I'm sort of hinting at. It's as if they can manipulate matter at the molecular level, which is like beyond woo.
Yeah, I mean that takes us into a whole new expansion of our current understandings of physics.
Yes, it does. Yes,
but I think the way things are these days, things seem to be so rapidly progressing across and numerous scientific fields at the moment, Jeff. Nothing surprises me anymore. So, in regards to your love of the poltergeist, what was your favourite case out of this wonderful volume of Scottish cases?
My favourite case, apart from the poltergeist that could sort of sing along or just carry one along. My favourite case, I like to go back to some of the really early ones because they are, in some cases, they're extensively documented. That's one of the things that I like about them, that the documentation may be a form of propaganda, but it's still sort of fascinating. Here's one of my favorite. This is from Aberdeenshire. It's not one that's not particularly well known. It's in a location called Botari in Aberdeenshire, and took place in the year 1644. Mm. So what we have, you have to remember that these places are incredibly rural. Mm. You know, they were everywhere was a long way from everywhere else, and most people did not travel at all. And so what we had was a guy called Alexander Christie. And he owned this farm, and he employed a labourer, a chap called Patrick Malcolm. And Malcolm had a reputation as a charmer, which meant something different then. It meant someone who practiced folk magic. Mm. He could charm away warts, or he could find lost objects, that kind of thing. But some charmers had a dodgy reputation as well. And in this case, he fastened onto the servant, Alexander Christie's servant. Her name was Margaret Barber. And basically he said, do you fancy having some love? And he said, no, absolutely not. In which case, and this is a really weird thing, he stole her shoe and told her that she would not earn her wages that year. Now, people who worked at the lowest level on farms in Aberdeenshire at the time, they would be paid annually or at the very most every 6 months.
Yes.
So they would live on the farm. They would have shelter, they would have food, but the actual money would only turn up once or maybe twice a year. Mm. So not earning her wages that year was a terrifying thing to tell her. Mm. That very night, stones and clods of peat rained down on the roof of the farm. And this carried on for 20 days and 20 nights. And everyone locally turned up to witness it. You know, not only the local reverend, but all the neighbors, all the farmers, they all wanted to know what was going on, and they witnessed it. Every night, stones and clods of peat would fall down on the roof. And it only stopped when Margaret Barber was fired. Mm. and thrust out of the farm without her wages. So she did not earn her wages.
Yes.
And it seems to us as manifestly very unfair, because it may be something to do with, you know, Patrick Malcolm's reputation. But we don't really know what was going on. But I think there's something so weird about that. So you have two, we presume, relatively young people. Mm. One of them tries to cop off with the other. The other one, the first one says, no way. Mm. And that night, things start to fall on the roof of the farm and carry on for 20 days.
Yeah.
That's one of my favourites, because it's just weird.
Yeah, I mean, as you refer to about the Chalmers as well, you know, there are several similar sort of situations south of the border as well.
Yeah.
Often we only hear of these people when they've been as malicious as Malcolm was in this particular case.
Yes, most Chalmers led lives that did not see them enter the history books. Mm. That is, they led, like the majority of people, for the majority of time, they led anonymous lives. So people like Chalmers only come down to us through history when they've basically done something, they've encountered the law in some way. Mm. You know, when their actions have upset some people. So either they've been accused of something, or they've been involved in a court case, or they have been fired by their employer and they've taken revenge and the employer has then taken further actions, or they found themselves up in front of the church court, in front of the presbytery. And someone has written this down. That's the only time when we hear about these people. The rest of the time, we have no idea what was going on in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, the other sad aspect of some of these cases is that, you know, it's usually the young maid servant that's usually framed as the focus,
or
whatever. And that's, you know, being sacked for allegedly manifesting a poltergeist is probably not the best thing to have on a young woman's CV in those
times.
I would say
her resume is probably severely damaged by that. But it's quite frustrating, this case, in a way, because the record just stopped. So we don't know what happened to Margaret Barber. But I'm guessing it would have been really difficult to get a job after that, because all the neighbours knew that somehow she was involved in this demonic infestation. That had affected the farm where she was working for 20 nights. So yeah, probably not a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I loved about some of the other stories, especially from the older centuries, is the fact that the locality seemed to think, oh, brilliant, we've got a new form of entertainment people would just turn up to watch it.
Yeah. And you see this again and again, particularly in 17th century cases. I mean, you know, life was probably pretty dull in the countryside, to be honest. But, you know, it was like, oh, look, there's a new hayrick. Oh, you know, but put it in the context of the time. People in London paid to go to mental asylums and watch the antics of the disturbed. Now, we think that's unpleasant now, but at the time it was regarded as fine entertainment. The suffering and bizarre behavior of others was, especially in the 17th and part of the 18th century, regarded as something that was worth pursuing. And so in these country areas where there's not that much news like this spreads like wildfire. And everyone turns up. Yeah, and you find this again and again in these rural Scottish cases, and that's why we've got so many witnesses, which is great. So all the local farmers and their families, and any one of the local gentry, and the reverend, and anyone of any curiosity turns up because they want to witness something extraordinary. It was kind of, you know, the YouTube of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I love the majority of these stories. There is usually either a local old lady who's come to convince herself of something, and she's generally holding on to some form of bedding,
Yes.
Or the local strongman who's gone, no, I'll show just I'm far stronger than this thing, who ends up being humiliated.
Yeah, that's right. And you also get religious visitors being mocked.
Yeah.
Their clothing cut with invisible knives or shears. Stones being thrown at people, muck being thrown at people. The poltergeist is a real snotty character in the stories.
Yeah, very much so. And they seem to thrive on it in certain places as well. It's as almost as if they're feeding off their notoriety.
Which is one of the sort of suppositions has been put forward, that there's something about it's like they seem to be able to consume the energy that the humans through the humans' curiosity, enthusiasm, fear, shock, and other reactions, that somehow this generates energy and the poltergeist gets stronger, reaches a crescendo, and then they fade away.
Yeah, I mean it's an interesting aspect to a lot of, as you refer to there, some of the older cases, is that if you look at the evidence and the sheer amount of witnesses, there are only two conclusions: either it's happened or they're all lying.
Yes, this brings me to one of my sort of like my favorite sort of hobby horses. This is the kind of thing that really annoys journalists. I take the view that there's no such thing as the paranormal. Either it happened, in which case it's normal, or it didn't happen, in which case it's fantasy. Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, a lot of the paranormal, we have this sort of woo element of the paranormal. But when you sort of break it down, either this is real, in which case it's not paranormal, it is just a new normal of the world, or it didn't happen. And as you say, if it did happen, that's really shocking. That's really a real shock to our belief system about how the world operates. And if it didn't happen, these dozens of witnesses who put their name to things were all lying.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I once had the privilege of speaking to Guy Lyon Playfair. Who is, you know, much missed and a real titan, especially in this particular field.
Because, the eminence grise of this subject area. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, especially without the Enfield case, his work in South American poltergeist.
Oh yeah, it's up in Brazil. It's just astonishing.
Yeah, some of those cases are. I mean, I think one of those was an extremely violent case. Did one of those involve somebody attempting to be poisoned?
Yes, it did. Yes, yes. Yeah, some of the South American poltergeists were at the extreme end of the spectrum.
Yeah, very very aggressive, from what I remember. It's been a couple of years, like I said. But he was exactly of that, and he obviously, because of his experience with Enfield, he was saying, regardless of the fact that yes, they caught them mucking about a couple of times, you simply could not write any of it off as a hoax, because it was such a variety of phenomena witnessed. But it's almost as if certain people, and it works both ways as well, Jeff. It's not just skeptical; it's belief as well. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they will seize on one particular piece of evidence and go, right, well, that proves it's all wrong, whilst ignoring the glaringly obvious other information in front of them.
This sort of brings me to something that I find of interest. In the analysis of the cases in the book on Scotland, I found that in 4.5% of the cases, there was definite evidence of hoax. Mm. And I looked at other surveys of poltergeists, and all of them came up with somewhere between, one of them said 3%, another one said 14%, that there was evidence of hoaxing. So there's hoaxing is ever present within a broader stretch of cases. But I think there's something, there's like a subsection of this when it comes to phenomena, when it comes to the poltergeists, which is that, I think this is quite difficult to prove, but it seems to, I glean it from looking at lots of cases, which is that the phenomena starts, it's real, it gets reported, and eventually people of status turn up to investigate it. It doesn't matter whether they're the local reverend or from the Society of Psychical Research or a scientist or a police officer, it doesn't matter. People of status turn up to investigate it. By the time they turn up, the phenomena may have disappeared or changed or declined. But the people at the focus of it, particularly if they're young, feel very important.
Yes.
Because special people have traveled all this way to see them. And possibly for the first time in their lives, they really feel that they are important. And so they may fake stuff to keep that interest going. This doesn't negate the other stuff that happened. It just means that when some people say, well, they fake that, therefore the whole thing must be fake. That doesn't compute.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a frustration. But like you say, you have the other aspect where certain paranormal investigators will try and insert themselves in certain cases or will simply focus on a particular piece of footage or response or whatever that's as frustrating, I feel.
Yes, I quite agree.
Yeah, oh, wonderful. So, obviously, your extensive library of paranormal literature is something to behold, Jeff. But as we referred to in the introduction, you've found yourself moving more into screenwriting in recent times. So how did that happen? Was that something you'd always wanted to do as well?
Absolutely not. No, it was simply the case that I think by that point I'd written 38 books. And I thought, well, I want a new creative challenge. And I thought, no, should I become a novelist? No, that's too much hard work. And I thought, well, what do I love? Oh, yeah, I really love movies. So I kind of thought, maybe I'll give it a go. Mm. You know, you never know. I didn't know anything about how to write a script. I discovered that I absolutely loved it. And that's it. Simple as that.
So did you just think, right, I'm just going to take the plunge, jump in, both feet, let's, you know, to hell with it.
Yeah, yeah. And I quickly realised that I was absolutely rubbish at it. Oh, rather, I had great ideas and I had great characters and situations and I could write exciting and scary action really easily, but I didn't know anything about structure or, you know, basically how to do it. So I went through a long process of education about that. But mostly what I did was I learned by doing it. You know, I learned from my mistakes.
I mean, did you find that whole process frustrating? Because, not that I'm wishing to cast aspersions on your character, Jeff, for somebody on the outside, they would probably assume that that would be quite a simple transition.
Well, they might assume that. I urge you to try, listeners, and report back with your tales of woe, your blood, sweat and tears, your confusion and your general depression at life and the fact that, you know, you cannot write for toffee and nobody wants to read you and it's all rubbish. That's basically the average day in a screenwriter's life.
Yes, I know a couple here in Sheffield and a couple of film producers. So I've had many a conversation.
Yes.
Well, or being surrounded by a very similar conversation of mutual self-loathing, I think.
Yes.
You know, it's the end of the world and that's that. So what have you found as kind of got your juices flowing in screenwriting?
You're not expecting me to say that I write baseball movies or intimate relationship dramas, are you?
I would be incredibly disappointed in
you. Yes,
if that was the case.
Now, I write horror, I write sci-fi, and I write action.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, have you as I mentioned, your film that you wrote, Dark Sense.
Co-wrote.
Co-wrote, sorry, Dark Sense. was premiered in the beginning of the year, which is a very intriguing story. So what's the basic premise of that?
It's adapted from a novel called First and Only. And the basic idea is that the central character is a psychic who foresees his own murder at the hands of a serial killer and then tries to do something about it and fails. Because if it was easy, everybody could do it, you know.
Well, exactly. Well, there is always that kind of Minority Report aspect to to anybody that if you knew the future, would you do what you could to try and change it?
He can't see the future very clearly. He just knows that he's going to be killed by this serial murderer. So that's the sort of basic thing. And right now, I can't tell you much about the details, but right now I've been hired to write a British supernatural horror movie with there's supernatural and there's horror and it's British, you know. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I wish you all the very best in that endeavour, Jeff.
Yes, thank you. There's lots of other stuff going on, which is part of the life of the screenwriter, which is that there's many, many projects and very, very little money. So until project finds finance, project is basically dormant. But that one's actually active at the moment.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Jeff, it's been absolutely lovely speaking to you today. Pleasure
as well.
Oh, well, thank you. Where can everybody keep up to date with what you're doing and find your books?
Okay, I've got a website, jeffholder.com. It talks about both my screenwriting and about my books.
Fantastic. And all your books are available on Amazon as well, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Well, Jeff, thank you again for your time today. Obviously, speaking to you in France, how long have you lived out there?
5 years now.
Oh, wonderful. Enjoying it?
It's quite pleasant.
I can only imagine. Well, listen, thank you again for your time today. It's been a real pleasure to have a chat with you. And thank you for the humorous and witty conversation. It's been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me, Paul. And good luck with the most excellent website.
Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Cheers.